this year like last year. The best is right here on CBS. This year like last year, the best is right here on CBS.
Could I just say I recommend Joe Radio? I think he's a very talented young man. Godspeed to you, Joe Artiger.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Joe Radio, 106.7 WJFK. It's Saturday night.
Joe Radio!
And we've got our guest on early tonight, and this is pretty awesome. Dave, are you there?
Yep, I'm here.
All right, everybody. My guest is Dave Lindorf. Dave, you're the author of a book called...
The Case for Impeachment.
The Case for Impeachment.
And co-author, actually, with Barbara Olshansky.
Oh, that's right. I forgot to mention that. But Dave, you're a very distinguished writer. I checked out your bio. You're all over the place. And I think we're just going to jump right into it. I'm going to come from my point of view. We've witnessed an impeachment recently in our country's history with the impeachment of President Clinton. And we all know what that was about. However, that pales in comparison with the case that you're going to make tonight, would you say?
They're not even comparable.
Right. And I think a lot of people, a lot of Americans like myself, you know, I know that the Bush and Cheney crew are definitely not playing an even deck. But what are some specifics that you can give me that would make the case, you know, Loctite, unbreakable, and all the more stronger?
Well, you know, over time, as I've pondered this and studied it, I've come down to thinking that the absolute greatest crime of this administration, and the one that really cries out for impeachment to really rescue the Constitution, is the issue of the claim of unitary executive power as practiced in his signing statements. And that takes a little explanation, but the danger is that if he's allowed to leave office with those actions left unchallenged, then every future president will assume that they have a dictatorial power and that Congress is just a talk shop.
Right, and here's the thing. It's easy to think that, but do you think we'll ever get back to the point where we get somebody of integrity that would say, okay, we're going to roll back a lot of what's done?
Yeah, but you can't roll it back, because okay, what'll happen is, you know, let's say we have Hillary Clinton, or and I don't trust her, actually,
no,
to do that, but let's say we have Barack Obama, and let's say that his better instincts come to the fore, and he did roll it back and said, I'm not going to use signing statements as a method for simply not enacting laws passed by Congress. Now, that would be an assertion, and he could even say, I think that the last president was abusing his power and shouldn't have done that. Okay, he's made an opinion, but a future president could say that he's going or she's going to do what Bush did and say Bush set the precedent and say Congress did not say no. So the fact that one president later says, I'm not going to do that, does not mean that that the precedent hasn't been set.
Okay, and you said that Congress won't say no. I couldn't agree with you more. You know, I'm down here in Washington, D.C., and in Northern Virginia, for that matter. And basically, for the first time in a local election, I voted for Jim Webb, Democrat senator for Virginia, hoping that things would, you know, that we would push these kind of things, you know, bring an end to this war, start a fiscal policy that's a little less crazy than the one we're in now. All the cronyism that's just blown out the doors, more so probably in our history. It's always been around. I understand that. But it's probably more so than any other time in our history. Now, what I found is that Congress, the Senate, they're not doing anything. Would you agree with that?
Yeah.
I'm sorry. And what I want to say is, why aren't our representatives holding Bush's feet to the fire on that specific point?
Well, that's a tougher one to fathom, and I've marveled at it, because normally the institutional imperative is preserving institutional power. So, I mean, you can look at any institution, and they tend to want to preserve the power they have and even expand on their power. But this Congress and the one before it have been surrendering powers right and left.
Yeah.
So that, you know, there has to be something at work here that's causing them to behave in a counterintuitive way and going against the grain of organizational behavior. And I can only think of two. One would be that they're so complicit in the crimes of this administration that they're afraid that the hearings would expose their own culpability. And I'm sure that certainly in defending Bush, his legal advisors would and political advisors would say, do that, you know, like call out the people like Hillary Clinton who supported a war that was a criminal endeavor.
I agree.
And call out the people in the Democratic side who endorsed the use of torture and who supported the overruling of most of the Bill of Rights and these kinds of things. And that would be a fear that I think some of them would have. But this thing with the signing statements is totally Bush's doing, Bush and Cheney. It's not something that Congress thought of or that Democrats said, hey, this is a good idea.
I thought originally that signing statements were like a right of the president, that it's been around for a long time. Am I mistaken on that?
No, that's a spin that the Bush administration's put on this, is to call it the signing statements.
They're spinning something?
That's why I said unitary executive, because that's the real issue. What they're asserting is, and most people don't understand this, and it's never been well reported in the media, in anywhere except the Boston Globe, and that is that the president is asserting that because he's the commander-in-chief in time of war. Now, the war he's talking about is the war on terror, and he's referring.
Yeah, I know.
He's referring to the 2001 authorization for use of military force, which was the authorization to go into Afghanistan after the Taliban and Al-Qaeda.
Mm-hmm.
And he claims, against all the evidence of the discussions on that act, that it wasn't just an authorization to go after the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, but that it was the authorization for a global war on terror that would have no borders and that would include the United States. So he's asserting that he is commander-in-chief within the borders of the United States in this war,
mm-hmm.
and that because of that, he has extraordinary powers as the commander-in-chief to do things like ignore the Constitution. There's nothing in the Constitution that says that. There's no term unitary executive in the Constitution. It's a total creation of these Federalist Society people.
Right, right.
And what if you accept it, it means that, you know, the war on terror will always be with us, because any time there's a possibility of an act of terror, or there is an act of terror anywhere in the world targeting an American person or property, then a president could assert that we're still in the war on terror. And, you know, when would that end? So,
well, never. I mean, because it's virtually an imaginary enemy. I'm not belittling the fact that these things are out there, but acts of terrorism have been happening not only from Islamic radicals, but, you know, you can look at the Atlanta Olympic bombing.
Sure, the Oklahoma City bombing.
Yeah, and even the Unabomber, even Ted Kaczynski.
Sure. We're always going to have acts of terror. And so if you accept that, you accept that in such a circumstance the president has dictatorial powers and Congress has no power, then essentially you can just take the Constitution and toss it out. It's now a museum piece.
Sadly enough, that's very true. That's why I'm having people like you on my show to explain this to my listeners, we've lost something in the last 7.5 years. And I resent people saying it's been going on longer than that, because it's really aggressively been taken.
Let me explain that.
Okay.
The signing statements go all the way back to, I believe, Madison was the first person to do a signing statement. But signing statements have never been used by any other president except this one to not enact a law of Congress. What the signing statements have always been, when they were used, was to be a statement of presidential opinion about a bill that he's signing. Right. So, in other words, they would sign a bill and say, "I don't think that this particular a lot of the signing statements that were used in the past were simply to say, "I really think this is a great bill," or something like that.
Or conversely, to say that I don't particularly agree with this, but this is what the Congress has brought me, and it is what it is.
To say that they think it's an unconstitutional bill, but they didn't say it's an unconstitutional bill, and therefore, in my power as commander in chief in time of war, or in using the power of unitary executive, which are the terms that Bush uses in his signing statements, I will not enact this part of the bill, or I will not obey this part of the bill. And that's what he's done. And sometimes it's been so egregious that he will, with a smiling face, sign a bill saying that, you know, he's signing it and having photos taken and handing out the pens.
Right.
And then there'll be a signing statement, which he doesn't talk about, which says that he's not going to be following the bill. So these are, and there have been 1,200 of these so far.
Yeah.
Some of them are very serious, like the Congress passed by something like, I think it was 99-1 in the Senate and an overwhelming majority in the House, a ban on torture. And Bush, this was when the signing statement first came to light. Bush signed that bill after first opposing it, then saying, okay, I can sign this. And then he did the signing statement saying that he wasn't bound by it because of the unitary executive rule. Now, you know, a lot of conservatives would say they like the fact that he isn't approving certain bills of Congress that were passed by the liberal Congress. But they need to think about this, because if this is accepted behavior, then, you know, when Barack Obama is president or Hillary Clinton is president, they will be able to do this. And if the Republicans are lucky enough to take over Congress 2 years later, which they might do, then they'll have a Democratic president who will say, I'm not going to obey these laws passed by Congress because
the precedent,
George Bush didn't.
The precedent has been set. Like any legal opinion, you know, a precedence is definitely a strong argument.
Yeah, and you know, in the courts, I'm very concerned that if they try the alternative measures to impeachment, they'll lose. You know, if they go to the Supreme Court on this and try to challenge it in court, then they lose, then we're in really bad shape. So the actual way to challenge this, the appropriate way to challenge an abuse of power, the way that that the Founding Fathers said Congress should challenge an abuse of power by an executive, is impeachment. It isn't, you know, one of the tragedies of the Clinton impeachment was that it was all done on legalisms. It was all a question of, did the president lie under oath?
Right.
And people got the mistaken notion that you impeach a president because he commits a crime, which is not the case. In fact, the Founding Fathers were very clear that they considered criminality and criminal behavior by a president to be far, far less serious than crimes against the Constitution. And those crimes, that's what they called high crimes and misdemeanors.
Right.
And they were referring there to abuse of power. All the letters back and forth about the debates they had on this made it clear that they were talking about abuse of power and that that was the purpose of impeachment. And there is no greater abuse of power than saying Congress doesn't matter. And people should know that the definition of the powers of the Congress are the first article of the Constitution. Article 1, the Founding Fathers considered, and I think rightly so, that the most powerful of the three branches had to be the Congress, because that was the one that was responsive to the people. And so they said, then they saw the danger of dictatorship in the executive, and so they created impeachment. And they said the legislature shall pass all laws. And then in Article 2, in defining the power of the president, they said the power of the president is to enact the laws of Congress. That's his job. It doesn't have an asterisk that says, unless he doesn't want to enact
right.
the law, or if he's commander-in-chief in time of war. It's not there. It says he shall enact the laws of Congress. So and there is no greater abuse of the Constitution than to overrule Article 1. So for the sake of the Constitution and the survival of divided, you know, the checks and balances that are critical to the survival of democratic government, they have to impeach. Okay. And yet, they're not doing it.
Yeah, and getting back to that, now you mentioned that, in fact, and remember when the Democrats took hold of Congress and the Senate, Pelosi came out and said impeachment's off the table. Now, do you think she said that because she knew that the Republicans and the administration would go after them as being in collusion with them on these things? And why won't somebody just stand up and say, yes, mistakes were made, but we've got to do something about it right now because it's only going to get worse?
Well, I think that part of it is pure stupidity and politics and lack of principle on the part of the Democratic leadership. That what they've done is they have, first of all, violated their oath of office, which is to uphold and defend the Constitution.
Tell me about it.
And secondly, I think so. Then what they do is instead of doing what their sworn duty is, they're thinking politically, and they're saying what's best for us in the 2008 election, which is totally irresponsible when the survival of the Constitution is at stake.
Well, not only that, they also came out and they said, oh, in order to get things done, we're going to need some of these Republicans. If we go right into this, we won't get anything done. But if they look at the last 7 years,
because they haven't done anything.
They couldn't do anything. The Republicans were jamming things right down their throat.
They haven't accomplished anything. I mean, they literally...
They're masochists. They're masochists, David. They love to be beat.
Here's what they did. They made a strategic decision that what they wanted to do was go into 2008 election saying to the American people, and you'll be hearing this soon, mm-hmm. We tried and tried and tried to do these things. We tried to, you know, pass environmental legislation. We tried to act on global warming. We tried to do this. We tried to do that. We tried to restore our civil liberties. But we can't do it because we don't have the votes. Give us more members of Congress. That's what they want to do. So they wanted to create this record of failure and then blame it on not having enough members.
Right.
And we wanted to end the war, but we just couldn't do it. And in fact, that's a lie. They have the votes, if they wanted to do it, to cut off funding for the war. And that's their power. They can end the war, which was what was done in Vietnam. They finally just cut off the funding.
Yeah.
So they have the power to do it. They won't use it. And what I think it all comes down to is a mistaken political calculation on the part of the leadership, which I think is going to return to haunt them this November. And that is that they think that the independent voter, the non-party registered voter, the middle of the road voter, is middle of the road, and because they sort of like Republicans and they sort of like Democrats. And the truth is, there are some people like that.
Yeah.
But most people who don't register with parties tend to be cynics about the political system and don't like either party.
I noticed that on your website you have a little area that says I'm through with this party or something.
Well, that's another.
We'll get to that. We'll get to that in a minute. But you keep going.
But my point is that actually the independent voter is more radical than liberal Democrats on many key issues. They're people who don't trust corporations. They're people who are sick of the war. They're people, and these are people, by the way, who are coming over and voting for Obama. They're why
sure.
He's doing so well. And if the Democratic Party were smart, they'd say, my God, those are the people that came over to the Democratic Party in record numbers last November, or in 06, rather, to give them control of Congress.
Right.
They're not going to come back in 2008 because they're going to be totally fed up and back into their cynical mode and say, why did I vote for these guys? They didn't do any of the things that they said they were going to do. They didn't defend the Constitution. They didn't end the war. And so they're risking losing those people. And if they don't get them, they're not going to win that election. They're not going to win the gains that they need to really control Congress.
Well, I'll tell you personally, as the reason that I voted Republican most of the time throughout my life is because from where I'm from here in Northern Virginia, we're generally conservative in our local governments. We like to keep, you know, things economically sound. But we had problems here with our last senator, and we've elected Webb. But mainly an anger vote to get things done 20 miles down the street to get things done. And it's not happening. Now, I wouldn't mind voting for Obama, but I just don't see him making it. I think that the powers that be in the Hillary camp are on their way to destroying them. And then we're going to be faced with McCain and Hillary. And there you go. A six, half dozen the other. You know, 6-1, half dozen the other. I am the people you're talking about, and that's why you're on my show.
And you did vote Democratic in 06, you said.
I did, and I enjoyed it. My right to exercise my own brain and say, this is all wrong, we got to do something about it.
And you thought that they were going to stop the war and defend your civil liberties, didn't you?
Actually, I've been living in D.C. all my life. I know how the game is played, but I voted for it. Okay, that's all I can do.
You were hoping they would do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, Dave, I got to go back to work. I work on a regular radio show during the week, and I come in on Saturdays. I've got two businesses of my own on the side. I got things going on.
Right.
I'm hiring people to do this for me, like the guy who cooked my steak sub tonight. I didn't have time to make it. I hired a guy to do it. He did a damn good job.
Well, that's what I think is happening. I think they're making a bad calculation that they have to play to this mythical middle of the road voter, the one that Jim Hightower famously said, you know, the only thing in the middle of the road are yellow stripes and dead armadillos.
And possums down here in Virginia.
Yeah, and I think that that's true. I think that the real middle, the real independent voter is not middle of the road. And that's why all the efforts Democrats make to appeal to that mythical middle don't work. But when they go to the hard issues of we need to end this war or we need to defend your civil liberties, those people come out of the woodwork. You come out of the woodwork and say, yeah, that's right. Thank you. You know, you might turn around and vote for Ron Paul, you know, as a protest vote. Or if the Democrats say the right things, you might conceivably say, as you did in 06, yes,
right,
so let's give them a shot. But are you going to do it again? I don't know.
Well, so, I don't know. You know, when Webb comes up in two more years, in 2010, I will review. But I can tell you, I've already written him letters. At 1 year, I wrote him a letter and listed everything that I'd voted him for and said, this is what you guys have done about it. Nothing, nothing, nothing.
Yeah,
nothing.
That's
a big, a big heaping, steaming plate of nothing.
Yeah, it's pathetic. So there we are. You know, I mean, I think that the only way this impeachment thing is going to happen is if people rise up and demand it, that Congress is not going to do it. It's going to have to be, you know, that's what happened with Nixon, by the way.
Sure.
It was not that Congress said, we got to get this guy. It was, there were 25 people that came forward and filed bills, articles of impeachment against him, and the rest of the Congress was saying, what the hell are you doing? Nobody's going to vote for this. You know, they didn't have the 2/3 in the Senate that could convict.
Right.
Nobody said back then, well, we can't do this. We don't have 2/3 in the Senate. That's like saying we don't have the jury packed yet, you know, so we can't indict. Nobody thinks that way. But that's what they're saying now. They're saying we can't impeach because we only have, you know, 51 votes in the Senate. And the way it worked with Nixon was that when they started holding hearings, the Senate Watergate hearings.
Right.
The public was so outraged at the behavior of this guy that they flooded the Congress with demands that he be impeached. And then that's when you got 25 people with some guts who filed bills of impeachment, and the hearings started. And as the hearings started, even Republicans started getting pressure, and you ultimately had one article that was voted out unanimously by the House Judiciary Committee and two others that had majority support with Republicans voting for impeachment too. None of those were just Democratic bills. And the reason that Nixon resigned was that Goldwater went to him and said, you know, you're going to lose in the Senate.
Yeah.
And because Republicans are going to vote for impeachment. And if you take it that far, then after you get out, you're going to be indicted and you're going to be convicted and you're going to end up in jail. So cut a deal. That's what they told him. And that would happen today. If they would get to the point of holding hearings and people were watching on live TV the testimony of underlings about the criminality and the treason of these two guys.
The people they can't get to right now, like Harriet Myers.
Now that's a good point.
You know, they can't get to them now.
Congress says, you know, Pelosi says, we'll investigate. And Henry Waxman says we're investigating. But then what happens is the administration stiffs them and says national security or executive privilege, and they don't deliver the goods. And if they take it to court, they're going to lose too, because the judges will uphold executive
yeah,
privilege
they will.
National security. But with impeachment, he can't do that.
Right.
He can't claim national security, and he certainly can't claim executive privilege in an impeachment hearing. And the difference too is that impeachment is the only action of the Congress that's written down in the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't say that the House will have a Judiciary Committee and a Ways and Means Committee. Those were all constructs by the Congress. But the impeachment action of Congress, the impeachment committee of Congress, is defined, and its powers are defined in the Constitution. So what does that mean? That means that when you get it, if the president tried to challenge its power, it would go to the Supreme Court directly, and people like Scalia, who I believe is a guy with a certain amount of integrity and principle, it's just I don't agree with his principles.
Sure.
He's a strict constructionist. He's going to look at the Constitution, and he's going to say, well, it says that the impeachment committee has the power to impeach, and it's absolute. So he would have to go by the Constitution and say, I'm sorry, but the impeachment authority is absolute.
Okay. So let me jump ahead a little bit here. We also hear from these people down the street on the Hill that Bush will be out in November, officially in January. We'll just wait it out. Now, fine, but can these things be picked up once he's out of office, or is he scot-free?
No, you can impeach after he leaves office, but it would never happen because the argument now is he's almost gone. The argument then will be he's gone.
Right.
You know, why dredge up, these sorry things?
How about the fact that he's committed treasonous crimes against the country?
Well, that's what should happen, but what they'll do is they'll say, the people are tired of this. We don't want, they don't want to have us dragging this divisive stuff about. That's what they'll do.
They'll see how tired I am when I'm down there with my pitchfork and hay.
Yeah, igniting fires under the basement of the Congress. But, that's what it's going to take. It's going to take a march of people with pitchforks to, and flaming stakes.
I'm thinking,
to get these guys to act.
I'm literally thinking of, later in the summer, once my show has gained some more momentum, of leading a very much a symbolic type of gathering down there where we actually dig up some hay, light it on fire.
I've got a better idea. Why don't you bring a long pole and a can of pitch and a bag of feathers?
Sure.
Because that's what these guys should be happen. They should be run out on a rail, tarred and feathered.
Yeah, but I like to think of the scene in Frankenstein when the villagers are all chasing him. It's the pitchforks and hay. You could tar and feather an effigy. But if I know you could, if you filed the right permits, you could absolutely do this because it's park property down there. If you had a fire engine down there to make sure nothing got out of hand,
I don't think the park police would allow pitchforks.
Yeah, well, because you might poke a gas bag on Capitol Hill and it might explode on you.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So it's a great idea, though. I mean, maybe you'd have to use symbolic pitchforks.
Maybe I could do it right out here. I could do it right out here in front of the station because Fairfax City. I grew up here, so I've got, I know people in the fire department. I know people in the police department.
Put corks on the end of the pitchfork.
Yeah, of course. Yes, and everybody will wear a helmet and we'll wear elbow pads, Oh, David, I could
21st century safety measures.
Yeah, exactly. And actually it won't even be real fire. It'll be like flashlights with orange silk on them so it looks like fire. Oh, what's happened to us, David?
Oh, I know. It's horrible, isn't it?
And I'm laughing, and I shouldn't be, but I invite my listeners just laugh at the absurdity of it all. Now, okay, so we've had a light moment there, and that's a good thing. Well, what about Vice President Cheney?
Well, he's even worse.
I know he is, but
they could get Cheney on what if Harry Truman were still in his original role, you know, he would be indicting him on war profiteering.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that's first and foremost.
And the other thing is that, that Cheney should actually be indicted because he doesn't have the protection of against indictment that the president has.
Well, to hear him tell it, he does. He is, you know. Well, we have.
Well, no, he says that he's not even a member of the executive. He says he's a member of the Senate.
Yeah.
Right? This is incredible.
Well, he is. Technically, he is the leader of the Senate.
Yeah, but he's also the second executive.
Well, we have a joke. We have a joke down here in D.C. Maybe you've heard it, but whenever Cheney goes in to get his heart restarted, he lets Georgie be the president.
Right, right. That's right. It's incredible.
And what people don't know about Cheney is he's actually undead because nobody could carry on the way he does and actually have a working heart and soul.
That's true. That's true. Touché.
But go ahead. Now, in Cheney's case, though, he could be more vulnerable after they're out of office, do you think? Could he be prosecuted maybe not through our representatives, but maybe more of on a state and or county or any other type of jurisdictional authority?
Well, that's an interesting question. He certainly could be, and he's so unpopular that that somebody might get away with doing that with him because of his unpopularity. But you know, the other thing is that he and George Bush are not going to be traveling outside the United States because they're also vulnerable to indictment in a number of countries.
Yeah,
all the countries of Europe have extraterritoriality on war crimes and human rights violations.
I heard a township in Vermont, I believe, has arrest on site.
There's two, Brattleboro and Marlboro, both passed town resolutions, town ordinances calling for their local prosecutors to draw up indictments on these guys for war crimes.
Oh, but David, why do they hate America so?
Yeah,
I got that from a cartoonist named Tom Tomorrow. I don't know.
Yeah, he's terrific.
Yeah, one of his lines. Oh, why do they hate America so?
Right.
But
well, actually, we love it.
Yeah. I mean, this country, listen, and I formed a business. I formed businesses left and right, and they fail, David. I mean, I'm not going to brag. I'm a lousy businessman.
Oh, it's like George Bush. Look where it got him.
I know, but I love the reason I do it. I exercise my right to do it because there's no other country really on the face of this earth where you can just hang out your shingle, you get your licenses straightened out, and go knocking on doors and say, this is what I'm doing. This is what I got. You want it.
That's right.
You really don't have that luxury. And I tell people all the time, they say, why do you have like a part-time business? It doesn't make you any money. You know, it does. But like last year, I wrote off, you know, $1,000, which I was, you know, allowed to do. It wasn't my goal to lose money. Hopefully this year will be better. But I tell people that in this country, you should almost be required. If you don't go to college, you should be required to form your own business almost. Almost like a service. You should learn how to negotiate things, you know, licensing. Maybe you'll need an accountant. I highly recommend it. Maybe you'll need a lawyer. I highly recommend it. But
well,
you'll learn.
As a freelancer who's had my own business since 79, I have to agree with you. I mean, it's definitely the way to go.
Well, you'll learn things that when you see these kind of things happening politically, you'll say, you know, that's not right. Because you'll know certain things. You'll know, like, for instance, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was illegal to form a corporation in this country for a number of years when it was founded. Am I right?
Oh, yeah. The corporate law was in the 19th century. I actually think that it should be eliminated. I think it's one of the things that's ruined the country is the corporate law.
I agree, except for one of my businesses was incorporated, and when my lawyer sent me my little thing, you know, declaring my corporation,
yeah,
it's basically a license to steal.
Yeah, exactly.
It really is.
And when it gets large enough, it steals people blind. And,
yeah.
And it also, what it does is it allows managers and shareholders to behave completely irresponsibly because they don't have to take ultimate responsibility for the actions of their corporate entity.
Well, let's say you say it should be eliminated. I say maybe it should be adjusted because it does also provide a certain amount of protection and allow people to take risks that they may not otherwise take.
Yeah, but that's the problem.
They're taking
risks with things like the planet,
right?
And they're doing it because they don't have to take responsibility for it. So, what we need is to have, if a corporation commits murder or poisons the water or all those things, the individuals behind it don't go to jail or don't get executed. And I think that ultimately what we need to do is to eliminate the corporation and make it directly that the shareholders and the managers are personally responsible for the results of their decisions.
Well, one way of maybe doing that, and I know this from, again, straighten me out, I'm an average guy, an average Joe. Perhaps a corporation in a sense where you have to take out insurance, just like you have to drive your car down the street. You have to be insured in case you wreck somebody's life or you wreck somebody's property. And
yeah, no, that's right.
But what about
you can't be insured against destroying a million lives or against killing people through, you know, bad industrial practice.
Yeah, but guess what? There would be somebody there to determine whether or not you did it deliberately. Or if, you know, something cataclysmic that an unforeseen act of God occurred. So, in other words, if the insurance said, well, okay, so your tanks blew up and battery acid spilled everywhere, but it's obvious that lightning struck it and made it happen, you know, you're off the hook. But if you didn't maintain your tanks and it's found that they're not going to cover, then you're liable. And I realize these.
Yeah, but that's just like in your private life. If something happens and it's not your fault, and your oil tank is struck by lightning and it blows up and pollutes the neighborhood, you're not going to be charged with criminal negligence.
Yeah.
For that, you know, you may have to pay for the cleanup, but.
There you go. We're talking in circles, and it's my fault because I've taken us completely off track. David, I could talk to you all night, but I'm going to give you a minute here. Go ahead and plug all your books, especially the impeachment book.
I definitely would like people to get The Case for Impeachment,
which is
now in paperback.
Beautiful.
And I would also urge people to go to my website, which is thiscan'tbehappening.net.
I love it, too.
And there's no apostrophe in that can't, just okay. thiscan'tbehappening.net. I've got three other books, but really that's the one. There's one by the same name as the website, This Can't Be Happening. It's still available at Amazon. If people are interested in the death penalty, I've got a book investigating this case of the longest-running death penalty prisoner who's a journalist on death row in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
That's called The Killing Time. And my other book is so old that even though it's relevant, I don't know whether you'd have to buy it in remainder. It's called The Marketplace Medicine, about the for-profit healthcare industry.
Well, I think America is already very well informed on that. But, I go to the used bookstore, I love it. So I'll look you up there. And I always tell people, go to the used bookstore. They have one of everything. So
that's right. That's right.
Now, before I let you go, on your website, there's something there that says, "I'm done with my party." Or,
oh yeah, yeah,
yeah.
I've got a campaign. I now have I think almost 1,000 people signed up. I'm calling on Democrats to organize mass demonstrations to march on their communities with as much press as possible and go into the registrar and deregister from the Democratic Party. And the reason is that we need to send a message to the Democratic Party that they can no longer count on us Democratic liberals to support them. We don't want to be on their mailing lists. We don't want to be asked for money. And they can't come and knock on our doors to get us to vote. They're going to have to do something first to get us back on their lists.
I love it. And David, I notice your resume. You write for Rolling Stone. And I noticed Mother Jones, a good, healthy American commie rag. When you say, I'm not knocking it. I read an issue of Mother Jones recently.
It's a good magazine.
You get such a different viewpoint, but you know, myself, I've you know, grown up believing half of what I've been told. And it's like, oh, Mother Jones, you don't want to read that. Well, maybe you do. So, but I wanted to ask you, with all, you know, you seem
Listen,
like...
Listen, I also write for American Conservative.
Well, that's a good commie. That's a fascist rag.
I'll write for anybody who'll publish me. I wrote for what was that smarmy skin mag, Swank?
Yeah, that, yeah, it sure was.
I did a great piece for them about debunking the whole POWMIA thing.
Wow.
As a scam.
Well, now, you seem like a bit of a rabble-rouser, but you got great arguments. My last question is, are you on the no-fly list?
I was
no kidding.
A lot to Taiwan and stuff, and I used to get S's marked on my boarding passes, and they would pull me aside, but it stopped. So I don't know. I seem not to be now, but I was like 2 years ago.
I swear to God, when I was going over your resume and your bio, I thought, you know, this is a perfect guy to ask. Sort of tongue-in-cheek, but, you know, maybe, I know I'll have you on again in the future, but I want to do more research on the no-fly list. I know there's a lot.
I actually broke the story that exposed that.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well,
since
I'm going to
go.
Way
back when.
I'm going to go find that story and I'll
read
up.
It's in Salon Magazine.
Yeah. Okay. Salon's excellent, too. I highly recommend that for my listeners. Well, David Lindorf, thank you so much for being on Joe Radio.
Thank you for having me.
I want to keep you in my Rolodex, and I want to shoot you emails every once in a while, so that we can kind of converse on things as they happen.
Good deal.
Because if I have people like you in my Rolodex, maybe one day I'll actually know what I'm talking about.
And you'll be on the NSA listening list.
Yeah, you know, I wonder with some of the topics that I broach on this show, I wonder for myself, and what I need to know is once I'm on there, how to get off, because I like to go to Vegas once a year. Just Vegas, you know.
Oh, you mean on the TSA list?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I was talking about the NSA list where they monitor your phone and your internet.
Oh, well, you know, I mean, I wasn't the cleanest kid growing up here in Fairfax. I've had my phone's taps. That's an old hat. I'm not afraid of that.
Well, the wonderful thing about the TSA list was that when I asked them that very question, they said there is no way to get off it because it's compiled by the TSA from names that are provided to them by all the different, you know, multiple letter or agencies from Homeland Security. So,
right.
And they said they can't tell you which agency your name came from, and the only thing that can take you off is the agency that supplied it. So it's this catch-22 that you can't get off once you're on.
I'm sorry, Mr. Lindorf, you're on the no-fly list. I am? I can't tell you that. You can't?
Right. No,
tell you what.
They can tell you if you're on, but they can't tell you how to get off because they can't tell you who put you on.
And it's just...
Don't you love it?
It's a symptom of our times because the whole thing about, like, George Bush's administration, it's like, well, we're not really winning the war. Yes, we are. No, we're not. Yes, we are.
He said it's romantic, and he wishes that he could be there.
Yeah.
Isn't that great? He didn't wish he could be there in Vietnam, but he wishes he could be there now.
Well, he's more than welcome to go.
Yeah,
he can. He can ride in the head tank.
Yep.
With his head sticking straight out. And I'm
wearing a funny hat.
And I'm not. And listen, honestly, on a personal level, you know, man to man, I've got nothing against George Bush. It's just the mismanagement of our country that I wonder why he's let it get to this point. And then I mean that. I mean that about any
record. God talked to him and told him to do it.
Yeah, God talks to a lot of people. I think God talked to Charlie Manson once.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And he talks to a lot of these guys wandering the streets in New York talking to themselves. and you know, and we elected one of those. The problem is people elected George Bush because they said that he seemed like a guy that they'd want to go have a beer with. The problem is you wouldn't want to have a beer with a guy who's an alkie on the wagon. But, you know, aside from that, George Bush probably is a fun guy to have a beer with. You know,
well, I'm from my used bookstore. I got Fortunate Son, and I don't know if you're familiar.
Yeah,
with that.
Yeah, that's a great book.
But I mean, the first third of the book, you're reading about him growing up and how most people got along with him in school, and you're thinking to yourself, you know, I can't wait to get to the end of this book because I want to know what the hell happened to this guy. You know, he's in the first third of the book. You're thinking, okay, he seems like a normal guy.
Yeah, but he's way out of his depth.
Yeah, I know.
That's the problem.
We all know that. Like I said, when Cheney goes into the hospital, he lets Georgie run the country for a little while.
He should have stuck with hanging around outside with people drinking beer and patting him on the back. That's what he's up to.
There you go. All right, David. Well, thanks so much, and I'll be in touch soon. I really enjoyed this.
I did, too.
Take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
So long.
Bye-bye. Well, there you go. David Lindorf, the case for impeachment. And that was a great interview. I don't mind saying it. The reason I have great interviews is because my guests astound me. I listen, the only thing I can do is pick them out. One of these days, I'm going to get a real dud. You know, it's just the law of averages. But I tell you what, David Lindorf, that's a smart guy there. I highly recommend that you read his books. Check out his website, thiscan'tbehappening.com, I believe. Thiscan'tbehappening.net. I'm sorry, I should have all this in front of me, but I had such a busy week. And I've got a lot more for you coming up. We are going to talk a little bit about the economy. We'll talk a little bit about the cost of war. You're certainly invited to call me, 800-636-1067. And we're going to talk a little bit about what I call the Spitzer thing. Elliot Spitzer, the governor of New York, getting caught literally pretty much with his pants down. And I'm going to try to approach it from an angle in my Joe way. That's a little different than what people have been talking about in the past week. So, stick around. I'm going to take a quick break. We'll be back with more Joe Radio on 106.7 WJFK FM.